Dan Levitard, if we're really being honest about it, it's just a giant piece of shit.
To the Big Suey.
Bald Eagles.
A podcast exclusive that none of our bosses asked for.
More sports.
More work. Less pay.
I haven't stopped talking in a month. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Just when you thought the show couldn't be more diluted. Bam.
Last time I listened to this show.
I haven't listened for years.
Now here's the marching band to nowhere.
Am I missing something? What am I missing?
The end of the story.
Fat face.
Chris Fallick.
It's Felica. He made him a penis.
And the habitual liar.
I didn't ask for any of this.
You asked for all of it.
The Big Suey.
I'm Chris Cody, BSPN.
This is what I want to know, because you can get dueling Codys all over the place. You could get them in the local hour. You could get them on the Greg Cody podcast featuring Greg Cody. Where was the better Tua Fitzpatrick argument had? Because I imagine we're getting reheated, recycled leftovers here on the local hour, because I know Greg Cody, he loves to double dip, and he's spectacularly lazy. If he's got an argument that he can make, he's going to make it in as multiple places as he can.
There was more than one conversation on Tua. I mean,
yes, they had
really?
One on the Greg Cody show featuring Greg Cody, which was earlier than his Tuesday appearance. And then they just did the recycled, reheated version here with us.
So they've had Tua.
That is correct, Stugat. You only asked that question so that you could get that joke off.
Bingo.
Well, the beauty of adding a podcast to my radio and print journalism duties is that I can now triple dip. So on the occasion of something like this story, you get a million different platforms of me essentially saying the same thing, which is glorious.
Well,
glorious.
Have you refined it? Like, did you guys do a better version? Because you're supposed to get better at this the more that you think about it, as opposed to redundancies.
I can give you my dad's take in like one sentence. This Tua thing is bigger, is more pressure now because of everything Ryan Fitzpatrick said. That Tua has more pressure on him because Ryan Fitzpatrick reacted to it the way he reacted. And I totally disagree, thinking that there was enough pressure on Tua, and one, you know, touching moment from Ryan Fitzpatrick doesn't amplify the pressure here.
Was his sentence more efficient?
Yeah, I didn't start that well.
Yeah, not a great start after recycling and reheating.
I love you.
Your dolphin takes. Honest to God, can I understand why we do this? Because I'd actually like to have this conversation. We do this all the time in sports media coverage. Who's the most pressure on? Is this 4 degrees more pressure than it would have been if Fitzpatrick hadn't said that? Couldn't we agree that just getting into a game behind center with Aaron Donald across from you, and it's your first game, that's maximum pressure?
Yes.
And couldn't we also agree that whatever pressure he's facing right now, he's more equipped to face than the pressure he was facing when he came out for Alabama and won the national championship with a deep throw? Like, what do you really think the pressure is going to do to a quarterback who is ready? Like, he might throw some balls high at the beginning of a game,
right?
But like, what can Ryan Fitzpatrick saying possibly have to do with Sunday's performance?
Not a lot, I don't think. You're right. You want your guys to be relaxed when they're doing what it is that they do. So maybe in the first quarter, first half. But you're right. Regardless of whenever he got this start, if they were 0-6, if they were 6-0, if it was the first game next year, it would be his first start in the NFL. And naturally, he's going to be a little bit nervous headed into that.
And that part I understand, but it's a bit maddening to me that so much of the coverage is a conversation. I know we have to manufacture some of this stuff as ESPN entities that are just burping out content on vast networks. And you're just going to get some contrived arguments or contrived conversation.
Oh, yeah. That's what Daddy likey. I say the pressure is on head coach Brian Flores. A gutsy call by the second year man to bench a proven starter in Ryan Fitzpatrick to go to the young lefty rookie quarterback lining up opposite of Aaron Donald. This is a ballsy call, and I like balls. Dan, you have the debate, Dan.
I'm glad you're here, because I actually wanted your take, Dirty Demon of Debate, on how you felt philosophically and generally about Max Kellerman finally on First Take yesterday announcing that he's been wrong for 6 years about Tom Brady and predicting a precipitous decline. Like, is that that seems to blaspheme against everything you represent symbolically.
Oh, I'm glad you asked. And once again, thank you for having me on. How are you doing today?
Good.
You're doing well?
Yes.
Sugash, how are you?
I'm doing good, Demon.
Oh, I'm great. That's great to hear. Guys, around the table, you guys good? You good?
You good?
Yeah, good. Pretty good. Thank you.
Good? Demon became very conversational.
I didn't know that's what he was doing there. I missed it.
But Demon care how he feel?
Allison, you good? Allison? Allison?
She's good. She's
all right,
good.
Here's
she's
my good. Whole take on Tom Brady. And it's the old adage, every dog has his day. Remember 3 weeks ago when he forgot what down it is, looking like an old man? Let's not forget that, okay? This guy's a bit of a front runner. You can tap into that occasionally. That's how aging works. You are what you consistently do, Tom Brady. And the last couple of weeks, I'll admit, I'll be the first guy in line to say, I'm impressed, right? He's looking good, even with that deep ball. But you gotta make the most of your weapons. You can't keep asking for more weapons when you got a guy like Mike Evans. You're killing my fantasy team here, TB12.
You didn't come close to answering my question.
Oh, no. Max?
Yes.
Well, has he apologized for his Kawhi Leonard take?
No.
No? No one's holding him accountable? And, you know, this whole media thing is getting out of whack. I don't know if you guys saw this over the weekend, but Pat Riley having difficulty on the Zoom, saying the Lakers title has an asterisk? I mean, where's the accountability from the media? They just took some words out of context and they ran with it. It's totally unfair.
Let's throw that over to Greg Cody, because we didn't talk at all about salty Pat Riley fiddling with the Zoom and bothered by the echo. The great joy for Mike Ryan, I don't think during the pandemic there has been a greater joy than him just realizing that every sports writing person who is on with us of a certain age, even Zach Lowe's age, has some trouble with the Zoom, even though the Zoom seems to be the easiest thing in the world.
Right.
It couldn't be much easier than it is. But what happened, Greg? What was your take on what the Dirty Demon was saying there regarding Pat Riley?
About putting an asterisk on the Lakers?
And just generally being salty.
Oh, you know, Pat's being Pat. I mean, he's been holed up for 6 months. He's the only time he's been seen is wearing a mask upside down. You know, it's tough being old like me and Pat. And having the winter of your life in a pandemic, it doubles down on the agony. But the asterisk thing, obviously, I don't really agree with.
I kind of understand. I don't know why he would say it, but I understand why he would think it. Like, I've talked to various people in the Miami Heat organization, and they're like, man, if we were healthy, like, we would have had a puncher's chance.
I think they would have won game four if Goran.
But is that what Riley's doing? Was it the bubble, no fans, no travel, or was it combination with our players were hurt, or was it just players are hurt?
I think it's all of it. Okay. And I think, you know, I told you guys he wasn't going to be happy with just finishing second place.
Yeah, but he's a bright guy. When someone poses the question and has asterisk in the question, you know you're walking into an aggregate trap. And sure as hell, like, his words got twisted. And he's to blame for that, honestly, because no asterisk, not for us. And this was what he was trying to say, but he didn't say it well enough to close the door on that. So he deserves to be aggregated the way that he was.
It's an interesting thing because as he has aged and, you know, this part is really difficult, Stugatz, because he says he will be here as long as Mickey Arison wants him here. But as he's aged, you have noticed he is out in front of cameras and microphones less and less. And we were going to do a podcast here recently.
Right.
And he's like, I'm just going to get in trouble. I'm going to do something that gets aggregated and
not worth it.
I mean, and so he's doing very little, right?
Right.
He comes out, Cody, he's not available. He used to be available all the time. He's available like once or twice a year now. And they do very little of putting him in front of cameras to speak for that reason. That's the reason that you don't hear from him more. Well, I shouldn't say that's the only reason. Another reason is he doesn't want to say something that's going to piss Spo off or give off that they're speaking in different voices.
That's to me, that's a bit sad only because Riley for so many years has been one of the elegant speakers, one of the people you want want to hear from in sports. Always a great storyteller.
No, but no, hold on a second. Forgive me. I'm saying specific. I'm not saying he's bad in front of the microphones. What I am saying is that he might say the thing that ends up in a headline because he's not searching the internet for when his comments get aggregated.
I know. And so for that reason, the fact that he just doesn't want to go through that, doesn't want that to happen, I find that to be a bit sad that he won't sit down, have a 45-minute, hour conversation with a friend because he's worried about that stuff. And to me, that stinks.
But
you
why
know?
Wouldn't he be? Like
Of course he should be.
He's doing his job. He doesn't want to he doesn't want to produce a single headline while the Heat are on a playoff run that makes it appear like he's taking credit or shine away from them. I understood. I totally understood why he would do that.
No, I totally understand as well. I just like to hear from Riley more. I miss hearing from Pat Riley often. He used to be a big part of the show. He used to be a big part, not just of this show. He used to just speak a lot, and now he doesn't. And to me, that's, I mean, I don't blame him, but to me, it's sad. I like to hear him speak.
Do you remember one of the first times we had him on the radio, how we wasted his time because we were playing 80 songs for him?
Yeah.
I was so mad. That was when I was listening as a fan. I didn't really get your whole shtick and why you would waste a man's time.
Oh, wait a minute. You weren't working here yet.
No, I wasn't.
You were pissed off at us?
Yeah, I was mad. I wanted to hear Pat Riley talk.
Right. Just so you know, I was mad at Dan also.
You guys think it's a bad idea to have Pat Riley on and get play for him 80 songs and ask him which one of them is better?
I mean, you're holding up an example of something that went pretty poorly. Like I get the concept, but the execution that time didn't work out.
You are totally right. I cannot dispute at all the fact that I'm holding up something that in the micro worked out pretty poorly. But in the macro, it worked out pretty bleeping well for everybody involved, given that we were playing two songs yesterday.
Yeah, no, I get it. What, you thought yesterday went well?
No, it didn't go well, but it's what the Empire...
You keep using bad examples.
It's what the Empire is built on.
We had a stretch, though, where the songs were great.
Yeah, Doliak, good example. Mike, yesterday, bad example.
Mike, you leaned into 2 minutes of staticky phone line yesterday. You leaned into it.
Because, that was our best song.
Because bad is good around here. We don't mind when it goes bad. Why do you think we have Cody on every Tuesday?
I do what I can, you know, whether it's a cough, whether it's unmuting my button at the wrong time. You know, I'm just trying to contribute, Dan.
No one better.
But that was so early on. I wasn't wise to your whole deal, right, which was just, hey, it's funny if we annoy you.
We doing Tua songs again today?
Yeah, I'd love to do Tua songs again today. We got no good ones yesterday, and it makes the producer's job appreciably harder to be just taking call after call that is terrible. And I don't think we're going to do better than just the Tua of us.
I'd like to, Mike, if you don't mind, when we get to that portion of the program today, I will come in there and help you out, screen a couple of calls.
Yeah.
Because I could see that you need the help, and I understand that. Yes.
See, where it suffers is I don't have the time to be super judicious with the nominees. I just have to get people on the line so we have something to go to. I can't say, it's a bit crap.
Right.
Just say, what's your name? For it.
Right. That's why having the entire shipping container, someone else in there, is very, very important, because I have them sing the first verse to me, and then I tell them where to start the song. Just to eliminate the fat.
Now, I do screen the songs to make sure we don't have 17 just the Tuas of us, because that's what happened yesterday.
That's how the Borat film ended with that song.
Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert!
Yeah, with poor CGI because they were making it during a pandemic.
That was not a spoiler alert to tell you the song playing during the credits.
People might not want
to. Put it on the poll, Guillermo, at Lebatard Show. Is it? Do you need to say spoiler alert if you're talking about the song that plays during the credits of a movie?
I saw it last night. I finally finished it. I started it on Friday, and I finally got around to finishing it. It's not as funny, and it's not for a lack of effort, because the access that he gets still is incredible, and he had to be super creative with it. Now Borat's wearing costumes to sort of hide the fact that it's this very because Borat in its own right is a very famous person walking around the streets, and they built that into the concept. I just think people being so transparently racist for whatever reason doesn't really pack the punch that it did prior to all of this going down, where it just seems more self-evident now. People seem to wear it on their shirts.
It was darker humor this time, and I would agree with you that it's not laugh out loud funny as much as previous incarnations of any of his characters, but the degree of difficulty on what he is doing. Like, just the idea, like, this is a brilliant man beyond the silly joke man. The idea that he's breaching security in some of these places to embarrass these people publicly in a way. I thought one of, this is a spoiler alert, but I thought that one of the best moments in the movie, and it's not, oddly enough, the Giuliani thing that you think it is, although it involves Giuliani, is.
There's another Giuliani thing?
Throughout the entire Giuliani 10 minutes or whatever it is, and I know many of you have seen the newsworthy elements of Giuliani appearing to, you know, I don't know, whatever you want to say about it. Giuliani was in a hotel room with a journalist who was purported to be the 15-year-old daughter of Borat, and he laid down on a bed, and he says he was tucking in his shirt, and it may have looked like he was fiddling with his nether regions. Regardless, I thought one of the things that he did, and this is the awkward directness of him that is just deeply uncomfortable, is while he's pretending to be the sound man on the Giuliani interview, he gets real close to his face, and he'd been doing like an accent. And he just says in what sounds like Sacha Baron Cohen's voice, why don't, like, right in Giuliani's face with a microphone pretending to, you know, fiddle with the sound, why don't you stick to marrying your cousin? And then backs off and disappears into the smoke. And it is clear that Giuliani's not sure that he heard it correctly, because I'm guessing most people don't say it that directly to his face, because he has actually he has married a cousin, and he just said it that close to his face. I don't understand how that dude doesn't break character, because you only get one shot at some of this stuff, Stugatz. You only get, once Giuliani's running out of the room, you're not getting him back.
Right. I don't know. I would absolutely break character if I were him. So I'm with you. It's pretty astounding. He's never broken character. There's never been.
I'm sure they've edited it out. But I'm just saying, they keep getting like, good moments.
Like during that fertile dance that they have in Macon, Georgia.
Oh, my God.
That
was
how can he not?
All right,
be
hold on
breaking?
A second. Hold on a second. This thing was amazing, Stugatz. Hold on. I don't want to give away too much
of the movie. Spoiler alert.
I don't want to do this. Cody, have you seen the movie yet? Because this seems like the kind of movie that you would get to, even though you haven't seen a movie since Swing Vote in the theater. This seems, and you have a recurring segment on the Greg Cody Show featuring Greg Cody that shows how infrequently you view movies and how little you know about movies. Yes. Is this one that you have hunted down because of your political leanings?
Funny enough, my wife and I watched it just last night, and some of the scenes, I told her a couple of times during the movie, this is tough to watch. It's uncomfortable to watch. You're sort of half smiling and half cringing, and the fertility dance you mentioned and the Holocaust.
Oh,
humor.
Wait a minute. The fertility dance, I damn near fell out of my bed laughing. And yes, of course it's uncomfortable.
Like supposed to be.
That's the whole thing, Greg. Like the whole, yes. Like, are you missing? The whole thing is not meant to be ha ha, you know, stand up comedy. The whole funny is in all of the awkward.
Right. I get that. But some of it, you know, crosses a line for me. And I have a very liberal line when it comes to that kind of thing.
Surprising.
What lines did he cross? The fertility dance crossed a line?
No, I thought some of the Holocaust humor and the humor at the expense of Jewish people, I thought was something that was tough to
The thing that is brilliant about it, okay? Because of course, Greg, the things that he was doing there are appalling. But he is parodying a character type in another part of the world.
Right.
Like the neighboring countries of Israel that have tried to kill the Jews. Like that is what he is parodying. And to me, it's how Robert Downey Jr. I was talking about this just yesterday with Bomani and Dominique, both of whom said, and with a degree of just uproarious pride, that Robert Downey Jr. should have won an Oscar over Heath Ledger for his role as a black man in Tropic Thunder, because of the layers of the joke, because he was making fun of people who do that. He was not just randomly doing Soul Man in blackface.
Right.
He was making fun of anybody who condones, blackface in Soul Man.
Right. Robert Downey Jr. in that movie, I think the whole concept behind it was he is in blackface, but it's a rib on white people, not a rib, obviously, on black people. Sacha Baron Cohen, who is Jewish, it's perhaps not as subtle. Even though it's funny to say Robert Downey Jr.'s comedy was subtle considering that he was in blackface, but it does make fun of himself some, and I guess there's some sort of leniency there, but it is making fun of how other people think of Israel and the Jewish people.
What he's doing as a Jew, Cody, and I don't know if this gives him the leeway to do it in your mind, but
he has a more of a leeway. Absolutely.
What he's doing is making fun of...
Oh, yeah, he flatly can't do it if he's not.
No, correct. You can't. He's making fun of Holocaust deniers. Like, he's almost the only one who can do it because of how afraid everyone is of anything that resembles Hitler humor and how it is that you're going to get... Like, everyone knows that that's one of the rails. Be careful over there.
I think for me, it's in the context of the times that the sequel to Borat is extra uncomfortable to watch is because, you know, we've become a racist country and an anti-Semite country in a way to a degree that we weren't 10 years ago or that we weren't as visibly. So, like, you know, when he's in the lodge with those two guys and they're doing all these QAnon conspiracy theories and everything, that's become reality.
But Greg, don't you think humor reflects the times? Because that's one of the things I am with anyone who is criticizing the movie. Hey, it felt amateur here. I didn't like the plot line. I didn't like the writing. I didn't find it as funny. I went in with expectations. I understand all of it. But to me, the man made a movie for the times during a pandemic. Like, it is so damn hard to even try any of what they were doing there during these times. And the idea that he did a movie that makes you uncomfortable and you don't know whether to laugh or not, like, isn't that where we are as a country right now? Sicker than any other country where you're like, you don't know whether to laugh or cry about how stupid we are and how stupidly we've handled this thing.
I walk around all day uncomfortable, not knowing whether I should be smiling, sad, crying, laughing. I have no idea. But Greg, here's the thing, because doesn't that character go after everyone? There are no boundaries, really, right? And so if you're going to laugh at some of the stuff he does aimed at other religions and other races, then you have to be okay with what he says about yours, I think, right?
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with that. It hit very close to home, this movie, because put a mirror on America, on an America that I really am uncomfortable seeing.
Well, but Greg, I don't know if you've seen the movie we've been talking about here, 537, the documentary with Billy Corbin. But what that inspired in me is like, man, this is funny. And it is also appalling. Like, it is both things. And I believe that what is happening in that movie, a comedy with a fake character, like, what, this is what I love about the performance art in it. I'm telling you that away from the joke man, this is a brilliant dude. He is brilliant and he also happens to be funny. And so he's stuck in this character. This is why he's doing some of the things he's making. He did that movie on Netflix or that docuseries. It wasn't a docuseries. It was just a series, The Spy, where he's just tackling history, espionage history that tackles some religious stuff because he wants to be taken more seriously. He doesn't want to be the guy opposite Ricky Bobby. I wanted to ask Roy this question because Chappelle was another one who, like Robert Downey Jr. and Sacha Baron Cohen, it's layered comedy, and the genius of Chappelle, or one of the geniuses of Chappelle, is that he wasn't making fun of black people. He was making fun of the way white people view black people. And Roy was saying he saw Chappelle on with Letterman. Letterman's been a hit or miss interviewer all his life. And as he's gotten older, this show that he is doing on Netflix is also hit or miss. He's getting great, great guests. And so I haven't seen this one with Chappelle, but I always thought that Chappelle quit the Chappelle show with $50 million on the table, went to South Africa, and people thought he was crazy. I always thought that he looked around and saw a whole bunch of people laughing and he didn't think that they understood the joke or what he was doing. And so Roy, did he give voice to that in any way when he was on with Letterman?
Yeah, he described the skit that he was working on Chappelle's show, which changed his mind on the entire situation. One of his crew members, who happened to be white, laughed at a sketch during the third season where he himself was in blackface, and he didn't like the fact that he was laughing at that. And that's pretty much what led him into actually quitting the show.
I always thought that he was walking into rooms in Hollywood where they wanted him to be the special Negro. And it's, you know, it's fun being that in Hollywood, in politics, in whatever it is, you know, the magical Negro, as they call sometimes artists who do this sort of stuff. And he'd be walking into rooms, and I imagine they were largely white rooms. And I imagine he was looking around, and I'm like, who am I doing this for? Who am I making money for? Like, do you guys actually get the joke, or do you guys just like that I have permission? See, this is what I thought the objection was. And Cody, it speaks to what you were saying. Sacha Baron Cohen can get away with some of the jokes he's making because he's Jewish. Dave Chappelle was giving permission, he felt like, it sounds like, spiritually, for the wrong people to laugh for the wrong reasons at what he was doing. You know how they hold Barkley up whenever, white people hold Barkley up whenever he agrees with their opinion or does something that feels like respectability politics, but anytime he says, yeah, that's racist, all of a sudden he becomes just another black guy. I always thought that that's what happened with Chappelle and his humor. Was it a good interview? Was it revealing? Because he's one of the guys that I've always wanted to talk to, Roy.
Yeah, it was a good interview, and Letterman's had a history of, you know, confronting his guests in interview sessions. He's kind of changed that during his new Netflix show, and it's very, very easy to interview Dave Chappelle because he can actually carry an interview. And Dave, in this episode, actually described the community of Yellow Springs that he lives in, and he basically said it's important to have a community in that episode, so I thought it was really good. He touched on the George Floyd killing, and basically what Dave told him was Letterman told Chappelle that he was basically waiting on Chappelle to respond to the George Floyd killing. Everybody was waiting on Dave Chappelle to respond to the George Floyd killing. And that tells you just how much of a philosopher that he's become within his stand-up. So him giving his opinion actually carries weight.
Well, he knows that. He actually spoke to it the first show that he did. Was it a YouTube show? The first show that he did after George Floyd.
It was on YouTube, but produced by Netflix, but they wanted everybody to have access to it.
Who else do you wish you could speak to?
Hold on a second. Let me just finish.
All sudden
let me just finish what I was saying before I forget about this YouTube special. He did that specifically because of what Roy was saying. He did that show to speak to people, and he said in that show, you trust me. You trust me. It's like what we did with Jon Stewart when we made him a newsman, even though he was a comedian. You trust me to tell you the truth. You expect to hear from me on things. And that too, Greg, speaking to your discomfort, that show was also both funny and dark. It was both funny and infuriating because he's sitting there explaining in the middle of a comedy routine. And he's like 8.5 minutes on a man's neck, 8.5 minutes on a man's neck. Like, that wasn't funny. You didn't know what to do with that because it didn't feel like any of Chappelle's other comedy specials.
It was beneath the surface, but I think he was also speaking to the fact that he is a reluctant tastemaker, influencer, even at times where our country is at its most divided. And he was sort of giving voice without admitting that he was wrong, which bothered a lot of people because he's been way off the mark, and it's been really disappointing to see his takes on the transgender community and stuff like that. So while he wasn't admitting that he was wrong, he's like, why do you look to me? I look to these people that were protesting. But it's just what it is, Dave, you know. Yeah, and he rose to the occasion this time. He's not perfect. He's never been.
But is it? But it's an interesting question to me. Is it his job? Like, what is his responsibility?
He certainly felt like it was his job in this moment. He rose to that occasion, and he shined a light on the people that deserved to probably have the light, and he tried to move out of it while still being the vessel for it.
Roy also, he also says when Dave Letterman asked Dave Chappelle, like, do you see yourself as a leader? He's like, no, I don't see myself as a leader. I don't want to be a leader. Like, that's for other people to do. I'm just here to kind of almost be a scribe of sorts as somebody that tells jokes. But I don't want to be a civil rights leader.
Yes, that's very much true, but that's just the way it is. I mean, people look to people to be leaders, and people are looking to Dave Chappelle to lead them, to actually educate them on what's going on in the world today.
This is a fascinating conversation to me, Cody, because I'm curious how it is that you manage this stuff. I'm not sure that I'm with Roy on the idea of, well, because we're looking to a leader, Dave, you have to accept the responsibility of being a leader. I've always been uncomfortable with this, Dugatz, and you know
what, assigning leadership.
I'm just sort of making someone else espouse a principle that they believe in publicly, like a Cal Ripken Jr. I've told you the story a million times that, you know, he was very rehearsed. And when I went to him and said, hey, do you have an opinion on politics? Do you have an opinion on abortion? His response was, yes, I do, and I will not be sharing them with you. And to just hide behind there because, and look at how it worked out for him.
Worked out well.
He became a leader, but just not a sports leader, a mythical sports leader, not like an activist leader.
But he doesn't have to become that if he doesn't want to become that.
But I understand it because, I mean, very clearly from that YouTube special produced by Netflix, you saw a man struggling to come to grips with the fact that he is this influencer. It's, look, I'm not proud of it. I wish I were as intellectual, but I look to people like Dave Chappelle to form my opinion on certain social issues, and sometimes I'm let down on certain social issues. The same way I seek out Mina Kimes' analysis on football to help.
She
form
won
my...
for you last night again.
Oh,
didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, yeah, man. The Bears defense can't stop a potent running attack.
They can't stop the run, yeah, and the Rams are running better than they have since the overs, Super Bowl.
Play the overs on both running backs there. But I seek other things out, and some people have echo chambers, and I seek out all sorts of opinions. For example, I wasted 12 minutes of my life out of curiosity, morbid curiosity, to see what Joe Rogan and Kanye West would do. And the second I can do this thing, Tony, I know you're a bit of a Kanye fan and you'll seek some of this stuff out. I can tell by the tone in Kanye's voice whether or not it's going to be a tremendous waste of my time. Because when he gets a little whiny, when you hear like the real Kanye West voice, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be 3 hours of gibberish. And sure as shit, I don't know what Joe Rogan was doing there either. He didn't even ask like a single pressing questions. I was dumber for those 12 minutes.
What he was doing was just having Kanye on.
Yeah, getting downloads of billions of dollars.
Exactly.
Well, getting back to Dave Chappelle, I can tell you that a good comedian can take a topical issue and make fun of it, but a great comedian can actually make you think about it and possibly change your mind. And that's what Dave Chappelle can actually do, which is why people think of him as a philosopher, even though he's just a comedian.
I get it. But Cody, what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on what is the responsibility of the philosopher? What is the responsibility of the comedian specifically? Because I'd understand any comedian who said, and keep in mind, I've said for years, Stugatz, as it regards athletes, it's not my preference. I want them to give us content. I want them to lead. I don't want Michael Jordan to squander a power that John Amici thinks could solve world hunger or could solve the world's water problem, because it's such a power to be the strongest athlete, and it can be a waste of a voice if you don't use that platform for anything. But what is the responsibility of the comedian to be a philosopher and a comedian, Cody? I'm sorry, a philosopher and a leader.
Well, I think by definition, the responsibility of a comedian is to make you laugh, just like the responsibility of an athlete is to perform on the field. And anything beyond that should be voluntary. I don't believe in foisting roles upon people if those roles are uncomfortable to them, whether it's leadership, whether it's being a role model, whether it's activism. Dave Chappelle has every right in the world to speak beyond comedy if and when he chooses. And you know, the Netflix YouTube comedy special he did was not a comedy special in the least. I watched it and was riveted. But I loved that he did it. I loved that he did it. But I don't feel like it's his responsibility to do it.
It's funny.
And he said that in the Letterman interview, and I agree with him.
Okay, but he can say that. This is the part, right, Stugatz? This right here is the part that I find interesting, because I just got done doing an interview with somebody who is who's writing a book on Charles Barkley.
Right.
And Charles Barkley, rather famously, right, while showing up on Sports Illustrated shirtless, pulling chains off of his body, like a slave depiction, famously said, "I am not a role model. I am not a role model." But this guy who's doing this book has learned in talking to people around Charles Barkley. I could give you 1,000 stories of the endless kindnesses that he shows to people, you know, just in a casino, putting, you know, chips that'll change a life in a janitor's pocket while walking by. Charles Barkley can say all he wants, "I'm not a role model," but the choice isn't his. And he becomes a role model. Like Charles right. Barkley has actually, while planting his flag on "I'm not a role model," he has spent 4 decades as a role model. It's not Chappelle's choice. It's not Barkley's choice. I'm not comfortable demanding from these people that insistence, demanding that they have my principles. But they don't get to choose. We do.
They don't get to choose, but they do have a choice. Excuse me. They do have a choice about how they use that power, the power of being a role model. And for Charles, I think he just likes to do things privately without a lot of cameras around and be that type of role model as opposed to doing it publicly on TV, where no, I think that's not...
No, but he's doing it both places.
I understand that, but I think he gets greater enjoyment out of walking through the streets of Miami with you or through a casino and just greeting people and saying hello and listening to them and giving advice and maybe sticking some chips in their pocket. I think he gets greater satisfaction out of that.
Maybe. He likes being famous a great deal. I'm not actually just talking about the private stuff. I'm talking more about... Greg, yes or no? Charles Barkley, everyone on this call, everyone on this Zoom call, yes or no? Charles Barkley is a role model, whether he wants to be or not. Like, he is. He's a role model for guys who want to speak their mind. He's a role model for broadcasters like Draymond Green who wants to get into the business. Whether he wants it or not, it's not, it doesn't matter whether he wants it or not. It doesn't matter how publicly he states it. Like, he's been on television across 4 decades. He's damn near Madonna, Stugatz. Damn near Madonna. He hasn't played a basketball game in a quarter of a century.
I mean, listen, it's fair to say, by extension of who he is and what it is that he has chosen to do, that yes, he is a role model for many, many people.
Wouldn't that make Stugatz a role model too?
Yes.
Yep.
Unfortunately.